O beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountain majesties above the fruited plain. America, America, God shed his grace on thee, and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea.
Catherine Lee Bates taught English at Wellesley College near Boston. In 1893, a trip out west inspired her to write America the Beautiful, which became one of the country's most famous anthems. The amber waves of grain were the fields of Kansas. The Rockies became purple mountain majesties. And in the last verse, thine alabaster cities gleam was a reference to the fabled White City of gleaming stucco and electric lights at the Chicago World's Fair. During the 6 months it was open, 27 million people, equivalent to half the US population, came to marvel. But by the time it closed in the autumn of 1893, the country was in the grip of its worst depression to date. Like most economic crises, this depression started with a stock market collapse and bank failures. For five consecutive years, unemployment soared above 10%. Workers faced savage wage cuts, while farmers watched the value of their amber waves of grain fall precipitously. The depression of the 1890s brought to a head the mounting antagonism between the beneficiaries and the victims of America's frenzied industrial revolution. So how had it come to this? America's farmers had in fact been on the skids for years. The price of wheat, cotton, corn and other crops had declined steadily since the Civil War, forcing proudly independent owners to mortgage their properties. Economists offered a simple explanation. Mechanized agriculture across the world from North America to Australia had led to a crisis of overproduction. But many farmers in the plains and the south blamed their falling income more personally on high freight rates and penal bank charges set by greedy capitalists in the East. They formed sales cooperatives to cut out middlemen and boost their own profits. These local farmers' alliances also provided support for the communities, and their mass family picnics had the atmosphere of revivalist meetings. Above all, through their newspapers and lectures, the alliances became a tool of political education in the backwaters of rural America. Novelist Elizabeth Higgins evoked the passions generated.
People commenced to think who had never thought before, and people talked who had seldom spoken. Everyone was talking and everyone was thinking. Thoughts and theories sprouted like weeds after a May shower.
By 1890, the National Farmers Alliance had more than a million members. Despairing of Republicans and Democrats alike, it went political, creating the People's Party, commonly known as the Populists. It reached out to black sharecroppers in the South and also gave a prominent role to women. A leading Kansas populist was Mary Elizabeth Lease, a tall, spare farm mother of four, but also a lawyer with a fiery Irish tongue.
What you farmers need to do is raise less corn and more hell. Wall Street owns the country. It is no longer a government of the people, by the people and for the people, but a government of Wall Street, by Wall Street and for Wall Street. Money rules.
The populists came up with far-reaching demands, including a graduated income tax and government ownership of the railroads. But by 1896, one issue predominated, the gold standard. Because there wasn't enough gold, critics claimed, this had restricted the money supply and pushed up prices. Instead, they advocated a currency with silver coins as readily available as gold. It was no coincidence that America's silver was mined in Rocky Mountain states that were populist strongholds. In 1896, the populist Silverites seized control of the Democratic Party from the bosses, nominating as candidate for the presidency William Jennings Bryan, a 36-year-old lawyer from Nebraska. Brian was a devout evangelical who believed liquor and gambling were sins. Like many populists, he treated the silver issue as a mixture of political campaign and religious crusade.
It is the issue of 1776 over again. Our ancestors, when but 3 million, had the courage to declare their political independence of every other nation upon earth. Shall we, their descendants, when we have grown to 70 million, declare that we are less independent than our forefathers? No, my friends. It will never be the judgment of this people if they dare to come out in the open field and defend the gold standard as a good thing. We shall fight them to the uttermost, saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold.
But Brian's silver crusade and evangelical style delighted the Republicans. Playing on the fears of business, they accumulated an unprecedentedly high campaign fund, outspending the Democrats by 10-1. Brian's passionate oratory was no match, and the Republican, William McKinley, won by a landslide. The 1896 election was a landmark in American politics. Not only did it bury the populists as a radical third-party alternative, it tarnished the Democrats as economically unsound and established the Republicans as the dominant party for a generation. In part, this was because of what had been happening in America's cities.
Fired by the mob.
Pandemonium of disorder.
July the 6th, 1894, 2 years before the election, the correspondent for the Washington Post could hardly contain his righteous excitement.
War of the bloodiest kind in Chicago is imminent, and before tomorrow goes by, the railroad lines and yards may be turned into battlefields, strewn with hundreds of dead and wounded. Chicago was never before the scene of such wild and desperate acts. Furious mobs have for hours at a time been in complete control of certain sections of the city.
One of the casualties was the White City of the 1893 World's Fair, which went up in flames, probably thanks to arsonists. What seemed like mob rule was a strike that had got out of hand. Workers at the Pullman plant in Chicago had walked out. They manufactured not only the plush Pullman sleepers, but railroad coaches and streetcars for most of the nation. The workers were provoked by savage wage cuts and by the refusal of George Pullman to make a parallel reduction of rents in the company town, which he ran like a feudal despot. The cause of the workers was taken up by the new American Railway Union, headed by Eugene Debs, who told them,
"The paternalism of Pullman is the same as the self-interest of a slaveholder in his human chattels. You are striking to avert slavery and degradation."
The strike soon spread beyond Chicago. Railroad workers across the West came out in sympathy, and union membership soared. But with government and the courts stacked against them, the strikers had little chance, and public opinion turned sour after the riots caused by fringe hoodlums. The US Army was sent in to supplement the state militia and local police, which enabled Pullman to bring in new workers, desperate for jobs, who signed no union pledges. The strike was broken. So too was the American Railway Union. Yet 1894 also destroyed the good name of George Pullman. When he died 3 years later, he was buried at night in a lead-lined coffin within a reinforced concrete vault covered with tons of cement. So fearful was his family that the grave would be desecrated by labour activists. For his pains, union leader Eugene Debs spent 6 months in jail. But during that time, he read Karl Marx, which helped convert him to socialism. Debs, with his bald, domed head and burning eyes, was a charismatic orator who ran 5 times as Socialist Party candidate for the presidency. Yet even at his peak in the election of 1912, he won only 6% of the popular vote. These were the years when socialism swept across Germany and France, and the Labour Party was becoming established in Britain. So why did socialism never catch on in the United States? Part of the answer is that Debs was, by European standards, an odd kind of socialist. Sure, he used the rhetoric of class struggle, but he never advocated a Labour Party on British lines. On the contrary, as socialist leader, he kept the unions at arm's length and fitted the rhetoric of socialism into the American political tradition. In his opinion, the real revolution that the United States needed was a return to the spirit of 1776.
American working men are not hereditary bondsmen. Their fathers were free-born, and their children yet have the ballot. It can make and unmake presidents and congresses and courts. It can abolish unjust laws and consign to eternal odium and oblivion unjust judges. It can sweep away trusts, syndicates, corporations, monopolies, and every other abnormal development of the money power designed to abridge the liberties of working men and enslave them, as cyclones scatter the leaves of the forest.
Around 1900, the struggle for the vote was a prime goal for workers in Britain and Germany. But in the United States, white adult males had been voters for decades. So workers felt no need for a new class party to advance their goals, particularly when, as we shall see, the two main parties started to adopt progressive reforms. America's unions also worked within the system. The biggest by far was the American Federation of Labour, or AFL, founded in 1886 and dominated for 40 years by Samuel Gompers. In Gompers' view, unions were an integral part of American business, like management, not a subversive force. And Gompers had no time for socialists, convinced that they cared only for their own party and aimed to rule or ruin the unions. He declared,
"A union man carrying a card cannot be a good citizen unless he upholds American institutions. We American trade unionists want to work out our problems in the spirit of true Americanism, a spirit that embodies our broadest and our highest ideals. We built the AFL in conformity with the original intent and purpose of America. With its success are involved the progress and the welfare of the great mass of American citizenship."
There was a view that socialism failed to catch on in America because of the high standard of living relative to Europe. In fact, millions of American workers lived in grinding poverty. Few enjoyed the rags-to-riches trajectory of an Andrew Carnegie. But many did rise into the middle class, or watched their children do so. Others simply moved to better jobs in another city. America's unusually high geographical mobility undermined the sense of local, working-class community so evident in urban Britain and Germany. Yet there was an even more important force at work in eroding class solidarity. America, more than ever around 1900, was a nation of immigrants.